From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So today is the day. Questions about William Barr, President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Justice, are being asked on Capitol Hill. He was Attorney General under George H.W. Bush, but today's hearings came after President Trump railed against the FBI and Robert Mueller's investigations into Trump's and Trump's campaign's possible ties to Russia. And with news that Barr himself wrote a memo critical of the Mueller probe and shared it with people in the administration, what some called an audition for the job of AG. Barr attempted to put some of those questions to rest today. Here he is before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I believe the Russians interfered or attempted to interfere with the election, and I think we have to get to the bottom of it.
Let's bring in NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Phil, is that your sense of how the hearings have gone?
It's been very professional and measured so far. The hearing is in a break now, but Barr has sought to reassure both Republicans and Democrats that he's going to be sensitive to their priorities. Democrats are focused on the special counsel's office. They want assurances that as Attorney General, he will not lean on Mueller. He won't cut the legs out from under Mueller. He won't cut off funding or interfere with the investigation in other ways. And Republicans have their own priorities. They want to talk about civil forfeiture and the rule of law and the responsiveness of the Justice Department to their inquiries. And Barr has tried to walk through the concerns of each member so far in the hearing. They're in a break now, but we expect them to return probably in a few minutes and then get started for a second round.
Well, the hearing started. Let's back up so people can hear it from the beginning. It started with former Judiciary Chair Chuck Grassley passing the gavel to Lindsey Graham. And then Senator Graham's rapid-fire line of questioning ran through many of the president's complaints against the FBI. And he also asked Barr directly about Robert Mueller. Let's listen to a little.
You say you've known Mueller a long time. Would you say you have a close relationship with Mr. Mueller?
I would say we were good friends.
Would you say that you understand him to be a fair-minded person?
Absolutely.
Do you trust him to be fair to the president and the country as a whole?
Yes.
Do you believe Mr. Mueller would be involved in a witch hunt against anybody?
I don't believe Mr. Mueller would be involved in a witch hunt.
Phil, just take for a second that this is the first time Graham has chaired this committee. It's his first big hearing.
That's right. Graham has taken the gavel from Chuck Grassley, the senator from Iowa, who was the committee for the last big round of these high-profile hearings the Judiciary Committee did. Graham is a high-profile political figure. He ran for president. He's been around. He's a very outspoken national security hawk and a kind of political frenemy for the president. Sometimes he supports him. Sometimes he's out there carrying water for the White House, trying to help with the attacks that the White House and the president have leveled against the FBI and the Justice Department. Sometimes he's very skeptical about the president's foreign policy outlook in Syria and Afghanistan. And he tried to strike a balance with Barr today about, on the one hand, protecting Mueller's office to the degree it needs it and permitting him to finish his work, but also investigating the investigators, picking up points about text messages between an FBI agent and an attorney that have embarrassed the Bureau, and reminding people that the deputy director and the director of the FBI before now were both fired after investigations there or because of the desires of the president and the Justice Department. And Barr's job will be to make Republicans feel good about that, but also Democrats feel good about the stability in the department going forward.
Well, let's listen to more. Here's the Democrat, Dianne Feinstein, speaking about the importance of the Mueller investigation in her opening remarks and asking about Barr's view of presidential power. Here's part of his answer.
In my opinion, if a president attempts to intervene in a matter that he has a stake in to protect himself, that should first be looked at as a breach of his constitutional duty.
An answer again to Dianne Feinstein. Look, was he asked at all about what we heard Amy Klobuchar talk about on Morning Edition this morning, that some people viewed a memo that Barr had written as sort of an audition because they saw it, the Democrats saw it, as being critical, not what we're hearing today in the hearings, but being critical of the Mueller investigation. Was he asked about that memo yet?
He was asked about that, and here's what he said. He said he had a conversation with the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, whom he also knows. These guys are all big-time legal players in Washington. And Rosenstein was sphinx-like, according to Barr, and he wanted to expound on their conversation with a written follow-up. And that's what prompted him to prepare that legal memo in which he argued there's no legal basis for Mueller to investigate the president for obstruction of justice. But he said it was also based on outside information, based on media reports. He didn't have any inside information as to the branch of law that Mueller has tried to follow or other sensitive aspects of the information that his investigators have developed. And he said that he's looking forward to learning those things if he's confirmed as attorney general. But overall, he tried to portray himself as someone who knows Mueller, who's supportive of his work, and who will continue to do that if he's confirmed, as appears likely, to take this job.
He said he can't see any reason why he'd be fired. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as the government shutdown hits day 25, it's starting to be felt by air travelers. Delta Airlines, which is headquartered in Atlanta, has responded to the chaos at the airport there yesterday when people missed flights because of TSA lines that lasted for hours. Delta now says it's deploying its own employees to help the TSA in non-screening tasks and is asking passengers to arrive up to 3 hours before their flights. That's because many TSA employees have been calling in sick since they're not getting paid during the shutdown. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
And what are you hearing about the situation today at major airports?
Well, look, there are two separate issues with respect to airports. One is air traffic control, where the workers are declared essential and need to be in, but there are some sick outs going there. And by the way, air traffic control is considered one of the highest stress jobs in the world, certainly in America. So the idea that these people may be missing mortgage payments or not getting paid is a problem. And then there's the TSA issue where, again, they've got to come in, but there are sick outs. People are calling out sick and causing others to work double shifts in some cases. And now we've seen instances in airports where they are shutting down some stations and forcing others to go through open stations. And the net result there is longer lineups. Now, TSA says very clearly, as of yesterday, their number are that 99% of passengers waited less than 30 minutes, 94% of passengers waited less than 15 minutes, but the fact is they have absences that were not planned on and lines are longer universally.
Six TSA checkpoints closed at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport in Atlanta. The Houston Airport, George Bush Intercontinental, and Miami have also had to close terminals due to staffing shortages. Is this impacting security, the job that they're doing, that's so important?
So the statistics say it's not, right? It's impacting flights. It's making flights delay. It's bad for efficiency because people have to get to airports earlier, and the airlines know they can't just be canceling or they can't just leave leaving people if it by no fault of their own they're stuck in security lines. TSA says it's not having an impact on security. There's a larger philosophical question about the fact that when people are overworked or working extra shifts or understaffed and they're under pressure to get people through so that they don't delay planes, whether or not things are getting overlooked or there isn't as much screening. The TSA has no response to that. They say nothing is changing in the way they're conducting security checks. But I think again, larger, it's like the air traffic controller issue. No incidents have been reported, but these are people. TSA and air traffic control have to be right 100% of the time. And that's the thing that weighs on people's minds at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And there was a report about this Delta passenger who got through security in Atlanta and flew to Tokyo with a firearm.
That's right.
And TSA says that had nothing to do with the
shutdown. And the response there, this does happen. And that's a different TSA problem. They were saying that's not connected to this particular government shutdown. One never knows, right? Do things that otherwise wouldn't happen when you've got less staff.
So my question is, why do you think the numbers are not higher of TSA agents calling out sick right now? They've been working now for weeks without a paycheck.
Yeah. I've spoken to so many people in so many unions and so many groups that have been affected by this. They're very, very frustrated. And the percentage of Americans who work paycheck to paycheck, who live paycheck to paycheck, is actually not different in the government. So there's a lot of frustration. They're hoping this ends soon. In some cases, people are calling out sick to do other jobs, which is, by the way, technically not legal for a lot of federal jobs, but to drive an Uber or to work part-time somewhere else so that they can at least get paid. Those who don't have to do that are taking the pay, and those who are working overtime will get paid for it when the government resumes. So, you know, I it all depends on how far this frustration goes and what people actually have to do in order to make their payrolls.
There's a former labor organizer who writes in the New York Times that the TSA employees should strike. How viable is that idea?
It's not viable at all. They can't strike, and it not isn't going to necessarily help their cause at the moment. The fact is, most Americans do think that the White House is responsible for the shutdown, and that's the way it goes. The longer it goes on, that's going to be something the White House is going to have to deal with. It doesn't seem viable that an illegal strike would work.
Ali, just real quick, do you see anything, a light at the end of the tunnel here in terms of the shutdown? Do you think it'll end soon?
I every time I think it's going to end soon, it doesn't end soon. So I know that there's been a bipartisan meeting of senators and members of Congress yesterday to try and find a road to end. But this comes down to Democrats not wanting to fund a wall and President Trump not wanting to give up on this.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
We will continue to watch all the effects of the government shutdown now in day 25. We all know the story of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the Roald Dahl book about a little boy who wins a tour of a spectacular chocolate factory run by Willy Wonka, a reclusive candy inventor. There was the 1971 movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
Well, the story was made into a Broadway musical and is now touring around the country. Joining me now is Noah Weisberg, who stars as Willy Wonka in the touring production. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
So people know this character probably most from Gene Wilder's depiction in the film. Also, Johnny Depp, a little weirder. I would say a little weirder of a depiction of Willy Wonka. Where do you get your inspiration? Because the way that you play it is different than both of those.
Yeah. So I had a decision to make. I grew up loving the Gene Wilder movie. And I actually never saw the Johnny Depp movie.
You never saw it. Okay.
I haven't. So I decided not to rewatch the Gene Wilder movie.
Uh-huh.
Because, first of all, he's genius, and I can't be him. And also, it's a movie, which means the camera can be 2 inches from your face, and he can, you know, raise his eyebrow, and you're like, oh, the emotion.
Uh-huh.
You can't do that on stage. And I just thought, it's going to be more fun to do my own version. And actors that I admire, I kind of did what they do, which is, I bring myself to the role. So in the context of being Willy Wonka in the costume and his mannerisms and physicality, but it's just me exposing my insecurities, my joy, my anger, and exploring those on stage.
So how does that play out in the show, do you think?
Well, the interesting thing is I've had people come to the stage door that don't know me, and they say, oh, wow, you've got this Gene Wilder quality. I'm like, that's really lucky because not intentional, but I'll take it. And I think what it does is it makes people connect to the character because it's really me up there.
I want to listen to a little bit of you singing in the show. This is a song that people remember Gene Wilder doing, but you do it as well. Here's Pure Imagination, just a little bit of it.
In a world of pure imagination, take a look and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a my creation.
How do you make that song your own here?
Well, I have the benefit of being surrounded by awesome actors, really great, well-trained actors on stage. And so what I do is I just sing to them. And I look at these real human beings, and they're playing characters, but they're my friends now. And I look at them, and especially little Charlie, who's an actual 11-year-old boy.
Right.
And I just think, gosh, if we could just get rid of this judgment that we all carry around and, you know, this third eye that judges ourselves, what if you could just change the world? It's so possible. So I just look at my friends on stage and and encourage them to do what I wish I could do.
Okay, well, so let's get to the story of the show. What do you think it is about this show? What is the message that we were supposed to take away from this show? And we played pure imagination there. Obviously, a big part of it is you should imagine, you should dream, you should think of things that aren't there. But what do you think is the takeaway?
Well, I think especially in our version, the message is that truth and kindness and selflessness is what wins. You have five kids that go through this factory tour. Four of them are bratty and out for themselves, and one kid, Charlie, is not.
Very poor.
Very poor, just so happy to have this experience. Mm-hmm. He's not trying to steal candy or get attention or fame from it. He's just spending time with his grandfather, who hasn't been out of a bed in 40 years, and they're having this great adventure. And so there's a reason why Charlie Bucket wins the contest at the end. And I think that's also the reason why he connects with Willie, because I think of Willie as just this child.
An older version of Charlie Bucket.
Yeah. And so there's that innocence and they connect. And within that innocence, sometimes that's why Willie, people think of him as this crazy guy who can scream one second, don't touch this. And then a second later be like, all right, on to the next room. And it's because that's what we do as kids. You're having the best time. Suddenly your mom takes away your toy and you're just enraged and then hands you something, a little piece of a candy or something. And you go, oh, I'm fine again. And that's because there aren't any veneers up. You're just purely yourself.
You know, one of the things that's different in this show, certainly than the movie that so many people have seen, is that the kids have been modernized. One of them, Mike TV, we remember Mike TV from movies, obsessed with TV. In this case, he's also addicted to Adderall and all kinds of other pills. His mother is a drunk. Violet Beauregard is a social media celebrity. It's a more modern version, more modern twist on this show, on this play.
Yeah, I think the show feels like timeless almost has this, especially because of the costumes, has this sort of old-fashioned feel, so it lends it towards what we remember from the movie. But yeah, they've modernized the characters, so they're more relatable, and I think I see people connecting with it.
When you do this role, you've got to, you know, switch around, do this, that, start singing. You're speaking very fast in many cases. It's a very physical show. You've got to run all over the stage and there are effects that happen. What is the most difficult part of it for you? What is the most difficult thing, single thing that you have to do in the show? And you're like, I want to make sure I get this exactly right.
I've lost about 20 pounds, literally.
I was going to ask how you stay healthy when you're on the road all the time, but that's interesting.
Yeah, I live very conservatively, so I try to get my rest, but it's physically crazy.
Like, there's a point where you have to pull gum out of Violet Beauregard's mouth and pull it all the way across the stage. Now, it's not really gum, but you have to pull it all the way across the stage.
Yeah. There's so many really cool, and I wish I could sit in the audience one time and just see.
Just watch it.
Yeah, because we have two great understudies for me, and I would love to get to see them do the role and get to see all the special effects that I can't see because I'm sort of a part of them. But diction to me is the most important thing, and vocal energy, which is the toughest thing to maintain your voice because you're doing it 8 times a week.
Making sure that everyone can understand exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, right, if you miss the words, you can be as funny as you are or touching as you are, but nobody knows what the heck you're talking about.
Right. Well, we deal with the same thing in radio when we're talking to somebody on the phone and it's a bad cell phone connection. It's like, you know, you could be a great guest, but if I can't hear what you're saying, it doesn't even matter.
Right.
What about working with these little kids? I mean, you mentioned that. 11-year-old co-star.
It's horrible because they're so good and they take all the attention away. So we have three young boys who play at 11 right. and 12. And they rotate just night by night.
Just because they have to go to school or what?
Yeah. Yeah. I think just to take a little pressure right. off of them. And they're so good. And they're good kids. They're not competitive and very supportive of each other. But it also keeps me and all of us on our game because every night's a little different.
You were in this show for the first time when you were 12.
Yeah. At a local children's theater in Chicago, I played Grandpa Joe. There's a good chance I was terrible. I was definitely going through puberty and couldn't hit the notes for I've Got a Golden Ticket. So I think I had to speak it. It's not a very high song, but I had to like, I've got a golden ticket. It was probably horrific.
Was that your first role or did you start acting much younger than that?
I started acting when I was 9. I always played sports because I think that's what a lot of kids do. And I never felt at home. I just didn't understand there were other things. And one time my mom said, hey, instead of doing the second session of sports camp, do you want to go to theater camp? I was like, there's a theater camp? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I never, except for maybe golf, yeah, I never played sports
again. And how do you like touring as opposed to staying on? You've been in some shows on Broadway.
Yeah. I like the idea that you get to see the country, but physically it's a little crazy because you're not only doing eight shows a week, you don't get to go back home to your house or your favorite restaurant or your family or friends. You're in different time zones, different set of allergies in each town, different hotels and, you know, Airbnbs and all that. So physically, I don't know that it's ideal for doing a show, but you're supported by the cast and by the adrenaline and the excitement of getting to do this show in different, usually historic, beautiful theaters.
And do you sort of think ahead to where you're going? I know you're going to Baltimore, you're going to Raleigh, Durham. Do you have time to think about where you're going next and what you're going to do when you get there and all that stuff?
No. No, the only thing you think about is housing, because they offer you housing options, mm-hmm. our company does, and then a lot of us try to get creative and get Airbnbs, so that's the
but
only
you don't
thing.
Have any sightseeing time or anything like that when you get to these places,
no,
or you do?
You do. You do. And so, yeah, you plan a little bit of that stuff, but no, you try to just get through the next show. And it's not like a burden. I mean, you want to do the show, but physically it's like going to the gym for 2.5 hours every day, but you can't skip any reps.
Did you read this book? This is a Roald Dahl book, obviously. Did you read it as a child?
I didn't as a child. I read it more recently.
Uh-huh.
And
it's dark.
It's dark. He's like a lot of these sort of fairy tale things, these morality tales, they're dark.
It's for kids, but also really I think it's for adults.
Yeah. Like the best Disney movies. Or, you know, animate.
Right.
This thing plays on two levels. And I look out into the audience and we see full-grown adults with no kids with them. They are there on date nights because they grew up loving this movie. And I think the show, and I can say this because I didn't write it, but I think it takes the movie to another level because you've got all the songs from the show that we love, Pure Imagination, Candyman, I've Got a Golden Ticket, the Oompa Loompa song. But then you've got this score of new songs written by the guys who wrote Hairspray.
That is Noah Weisberg, who stars as Willy Wonka in the touring production of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. We've got more information on the show at hereandnow.org. Noah, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Don't come in!
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The latest chapter in the controversy over the so-called Silent Sam Confederate statue at North Carolina's flagship public university, UNC Chapel Hill, is still unfolding. Overnight, the pedestal that used to hold the statue was removed from campus, and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt announced her retirement this coming spring, moves which caught the University Board of Governors by surprise. Dave DeWitt, managing editor at WUNC, is in Durham. Dave, nice to speak with you.
Hi, Robin.
And remember that Silent Sam, who replaces, who represents rather all Confederate soldiers, had been in place since 1913 when the United Daughters of the Confederacy put the statue up in the Jim Crow era. It was toppled by protesters last August. Its base and some plaques were there. So just talk about why this removal was so sudden, one in the morning.
Yeah, it caught everybody by surprise. About 5 o'clock last night, Carol Folt sent out a message saying that she was going to resign as chancellor at the end of the academic year, and then also that Silent Sam's pedestal and the other plaques that were there were going to be removed. At that time, she didn't say when that was going to happen. There was a bit of a celebration then at, 7 o'clock last night. There were some people around there, about a couple dozen students and activists, and then at 1 o'clock or so in the morning came the big trucks and the crane, and they picked up the pedestal, the monuments, or what was left of the monument, and took it away. So nobody knows really where it went, and nobody knows really where Silent Sam is at this point. But it was a quick end to that, and it had been going on for, as you know, several months.
Well, it's interesting because maybe the school was concerned that there would be some sort of violent reaction to this, but it also could have been an opportunity, some sort of a ritualistic opportunity to have people involved in the removal. But as to her announcing her retirement, she said that and the statue's removal had nothing to do with each other. Let's listen.
I really have not wanted my job status to be part of my decision-making about the monument, and it has not been. I have not used it in that way. That's not how I've thought about it. I try to do the right thing regardless of that effect on my job situation.
Well, but the chair of the Board of Governors said the removal lacked transparency. They're meeting to talk about this. Do people think that the two had nothing to do with each other?
Yes. Even Carol Folt at the in that same press conference said, I know that might be hard to believe that they're not linked. And it really is hard to believe because in the notice she sent out, she linked them together in the same announcement. She said that she was, you know, leaving. And then the next thing she said is the Silent Sam pedestal being removed. And because of how quickly it happened last night, the Board of Governors met and she sent out her notice while that meeting was still taking place. So they were not only caught off guard, but they're a little bit angry today, so there's a lot of speculation about what comes next.
Because with her retirement, maybe the next chancellor should have made the decision about the base there. But there's been a strict law in place since 2015 that prohibits the alteration or removal of objects of remembrance except in narrow circumstances. So that has to be considered. Also, Silent Sam, he's in pieces somewhere. She had originally wanted to build an historic structure, a museum around the smashed portion. That was vetoed. Just in the 30 seconds we have, what happens now to these pieces?
Well, these pieces, as you said, if you think of sort of the Raiders of the Lost Ark, that last scene where they're just taken away to some sort of deep cavern somewhere, nobody knows where they are. They are somewhere on campus. That's all she said. What could happen is this law could get challenged and it could get put right back up.
Right. Dave DeWitt, managing editor at WUNC, and we'll talk to you if that happens. Thank you.
My pleasure.
The 18-year-old Saudi woman who fled her home with claims of abuse gave an interview yesterday to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation explaining why she tried to flee to Australia through Thailand. She said, I wanted to be free from abuse and depression. I wouldn't be able to marry who I wanted. Well, when she got to Thailand, as you remember, her passport was confiscated. She went on social media, became an international cause, ending up in Canada. Then there's the Emirati princess, who says she tried to flee an abusive home in the UAE, but was foiled. On YouTube, she said her father ordered men to capture her.
Yeah, they put me in prison and they tortured me. Basically, one guy was holding me while the other guy was beating me.
But then her family asked Mary Robinson, former president of Ireland, former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, to come see the princess. And Robinson came to this conclusion, speaking with the BBC.
This is a troubled young woman who has a serious medical situation. She's receiving psychiatric care, and they don't want her to endure any more publicity. This is a family matter now, and that she is in the care and loving care of her family.
Well, activists, including those at Human Rights Watch, were outraged. Phil Robertson is the group's Asia deputy director. Let's check in with both stories now with him. Phil, welcome.
Hi.
To the teen in Canada first, Rahaf Al-Qanoon. How is she doing?
She's in a much better place right now. She's happy. She's relieved that she has escaped her ordeal. She is now, I think, finally experiencing the new life that she dreamed for herself.
Well, talk about why she was even detained by the Thai officials in the first place, as she was trying actually to get to Australia. Saudi Arabia, now led by Prince Salman, most recently accused by U.S. intelligence officials of being behind the murder of a journalist. Before that, was getting a lot of positive press for claiming he was liberating women. They were allowed to drive. But less well known is he still oversees the punitive guardian system in Saudi Arabia. Just explain that.
The bottom line is that women in Saudi Arabia are considered to be legal minors. They are always required to have permission from a male guardian to do basic things in their lives, taking a job. It could be going to study, simply moving around. And until recently, it was also that they were barred from driving. So they're controlled in many different ways through this guardian system. And in this case, that's why she had to flee from Kuwait, from a family holiday in that country, because there was no way she could leave from Saudi Arabia because she would never get permission from her guardian to get on a flight.
Do other countries respect that Saudi law? Because It sounds as if the Thai officials stopped her.
What happened actually was a Thai officer of the Saudi embassy was the person who stopped her and took her passport. He then arranged for her to sign a Thai language form that she couldn't understand and was told to wait. She did for a period of time, and he finally came back and informed her that her father missed her very much and wanted her to go back and that she was not allowed to enter into Thailand. Mm. What he had done is evidently taken the paperwork to engineer the rejection of a visa on arrival for her, and that was the legal premise for her to be sent back to Kuwait. Part of it also, I think, is, at least in the case of Rahaf, that perhaps the Saudi embassy misrepresented what the situation was to the Thai government. They said that that the family had filed a missing persons request in Kuwait, and they just asked for help to get her back to the family. And when asked about this by media, the Thai immigration commissioner, Khun Sorichet Hakpan, said, well, you know, this is a family matter. But as the Twitter following for Rahaf increased and as the media got more involved, it became quite clear that there was much more to it.
So the Saudi reach, you know, it reaches into other countries. As we know, she barricaded herself. She sent out messages on social media in Arabic. And Canada has now stepped in. By the way, your own Kenneth Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch, criticized Australia, saying that they slow-walked this, that they should have been quicker in helping her go from Thailand to Australia. Instead, Canada stepped in.
Well, what happened was her father and her brother, the two male relatives she'd feared the most who had subjected her to psychological and physical abuse, arrived in Thailand after the UN had taken her under their protection. And the fear was that there would be something done. Some sort of effort to get her back under their control would be taken. And so Australia said they would take her. But then Peter Dutton, the Minister of Home Affairs, said that her application would be processed the same way that as all other refugee applications are processed. And it could be weeks for that to happen. And Canada was right there and ready to do it.
Well, a couple of things. I asked you if other countries respect Saudi law. Maybe other countries, though, definitely fear Saudi retribution and a worsening of relations with Saudi Arabia, which is why they might not act as quickly.
I think that's part of it.
Well, let's talk about Sheikha Latifa, the Emirati princess. She was on the yacht of a former French spy in her second attempt to escape the UAE when she was snatched back by UAE officials. And then you have Mary Robinson, who says the princess is troubled and receiving psychiatric treatment. But the princess's supporters say that Robinson was reading from Dubai's script. Your executive director, again, Kenneth Roth, said, well, you say the UAE princess is troubled, which suggests a pre-existing condition. I'd be troubled, too, if I tried to escape a gilded prison and was kidnapped back. I mean, if Mary Robinson, highly respected, says that this actually is a different case, this is a young girl who has psychiatric issues and sides with the family, how do you as Human Rights Watch know she's not right?
The problem is this. This is the common pushback by the families. When women try to leave, they said that there's some sort of mental imbalance or a psychiatric problem. The father and the brother were saying the same thing about Rahaf. And it's very concerning that Mary Robinson would go and endorse that narrative. I mean, last time I checked, she's not a psychiatrist. It's really, in my view, something that she should not have done. Mm. And I think that in many of these cases, it goes back to the sort of basic application of international human rights law. If this woman is of majority age, if she's 18 years or older and she decides she wants to leave, she should be allowed to do so.
We reached out to Mary Robinson, who's been a frequent guest on the program and is usually very eager to talk about human rights issues. But she sent us a statement that she's dismayed at some of the comments about her, that she made her assessment, not a judgment, on witness and in good faith. Can we presume that unless somebody barricades themselves in a hotel room in Thailand or the former president of Ireland gets involved, there are more of these stories than we hear about?
There are many more cases than we know about. We know, for instance, just from Rahaf and her friends, that several of her friends had escaped. The successful escapes we don't hear about. It's the ones that, for instance, the Dina Ali case in the Philippines in 2017, where she was intercepted. She had her passport taken away by the Philippines government. you know, who held her until her relatives came from Saudi Arabia and basically carried her kicking and screaming back onto the plane. Mm. We hear about those cases. I think there are many more cases that are out there, and I think there are many more cases that are going to be coming up because Rahaf has succeeded beyond all expectations.
Do you know, by the way, Phil, what Rahaf Al-Qunun plans to do? Is she going to completely make her life in Canada? She can't go home.
Well, I think at this point she's going to be in Canada for quite some time.
Right.
She had talked about studying architecture. Yeah. And, you know, I think she realizes now that she's got an entire world in front of her. I think the fact that she escaped in such a high-profile way is also going to cause some limitations on what she can do because she has to be careful of her security.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that. We saw what happened to, a Saudi journalist from America who was in Turkey and was snatched at the Saudi consulate there. So how far might her family go to try to get her back?
Well, I think the fact that she's in Canada and the fact that Canada and Saudi Arabia have basically ruptured relations because Canada criticized Saudi Arabia's human rights record with good reason, and Saudi Arabia retaliated by kicking out the ambassador and cutting trade talk relations. But I think also what will happen is there's a network of feminists from Saudi Arabia and other parts of the Gulf who are increasingly intertwined and engaged in sort of supporting women like Rahaf who've come out and helping them escape. With this kind of story and the kind of support that was seen in the international community for Rahaf, I think that they are looking to do much more. And that also means, of course, making sure that people are protected. And there's a lot of precautions taking place. I think that that is something that we can't really talk about too much. But the reality is that this is a government in Saudi Arabia that is prepared to pursue these women a great length across the world in a way that is shameful, it's outrageous, and it has to stop.
Phil Robertson, Deputy Director of the Human Rights Watch Asia Division, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Google employees are protesting on social media today against a practice known as forced arbitration. That's when companies handle workplace issues behind closed doors rather than in court. The Google employees who were successful in getting Google to end forced arbitration for sexual harassment claims back in November now want to see that new policy expanded to include other kinds of discrimination, and they want it to apply to contract workers as well as staff employees. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Shireen Ghaffari has been following the story for Recode. She joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So why are employees there at Google so up in arms about forced arbitration when they successfully won those concessions when it comes to sexual harassment back in November?
Well, because they only won those concessions in a limited number of cases, specifically for sexual harassment and assault. And forced arbitration is something that employers can put in their employees' contracts that basically forces the workers to waive their right to sue their employer if they have a workplace dispute later down the line.
Right. But a lot of companies do that. Would Google open itself up to the risk of getting sued by employees if they allow these things to be settled in court rather than in forced arbitration?
Yeah, well, courts can take much more time than arbitration, which is a private process and does not include a jury or a judge, but instead a privately appointed arbitrator. And so obviously that is not a situation that Google and most other companies would want in every case because that can cost more and that can take more time. However, the employees are making a strong case that their workers deserve a right to have a fair trial in court and not through a private process where they're less likely to win if they are an employee with a workplace dispute.
So tell us what exactly they're doing today, because in this case, they're not doing a walkout. This is all being done on social media.
Right. So today they're basically running a social media blitz, and every hour and every half hour on Twitter and Instagram, they're posting information about how arbitration, in their view, can stifle employees' civil rights and why they believe that it should be limited.
Mm-hmm. And are they hoping that they're going to actually get something concrete today, or that this is just the start of a bigger movement?
I believe this is a start of a bigger movement, and it's something that's spun out of the Google walkout. And so you're seeing different groups with different focuses. You know, some are more focused on getting more rights for contract workers at Google and tech companies. Some are focused on this forced arbitration issue. And so I think what they're trying to achieve is just greater awareness. They surveyed something like 30 of the major tech companies and found that none of them met some basic requirements for having what they believe is a fair set of rights for employees to be able to take their employer to court.
Do we know who is driving this movement?
Yeah, so it's a group of workers within Google, and they have come up with a group name. They're called Googlers to End Forced Arbitration, and they're trying to form a coalition with tech workers at other major tech companies as well.
Now, this is not happening in a vacuum. Google shareholders just last week filed a lawsuit against Google's parent company, Alphabet, over its handling of past sexual harassment cases. Does that pressure play into this?
Oh, absolutely. I think that if there were no major issues around workplace culture and sexual harassment and discrimination at tech companies, then there would be less pressure to sort of change some of the systemic practices that employees are saying enables these kinds of issues to happen. So I think because tech companies are having major negative news events, I think that can act as a forcing function to get management to maybe rethink some of the policies that they have.
And it's not just forced arbitration. Google employees have been hammering the company for its relationship with the Pentagon, for its aspirations in China. Give us a sense just of what's going on at Google right now. It's a lot of anger on the part of employees, it seems like.
Well, Google has a long history of allowing its employees to kind of debate a lot of the way that, you know, the company is run, essentially. And of course, you have some of the best and brightest employees in the world working there who are going to have different ideas about how things should be run. And I think what you're seeing now is some of the discussions come out in the open after employees feel that management hasn't been responsive to some of the internal debate. So that's why you're seeing debates around how Google's technology should be used ethically, and if it's ethical to use Google's technology for defense for drones, or in this case, how Google should ethically run its HR and its employment practices.
That is Shireen Ghaffari, who has been covering today's Google protests on social media for Recode. Shireen, thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, we are following a lot of other stories today. It is day 25 of the government shutdown in Washington. No end in sight there. We're also watching what's happening in London. In just hours from now, the Parliament is expected to vote on Theresa May's Brexit plan. Has had basically not enough support so far to get through. And if it doesn't, the question is, what happens next? Will there be a crash out of the European Union by the UK or some other plan, or perhaps even a second referendum? Many people are talking about that. We will follow all of that right here on Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson along with Robin Young. Stay with us. It's Here and Now.